Philip II of Macedonia. The situation in 340 BCE. Part 1. By 340 BCE, Philip was stronger and far harder for Athens to damage. But success came at a cost. He had made Macedonia secure and powerful, which meant that other states were bound to see it as more dangerous. For the moment, the majority remained inclined to see conflict with Philip as Athens' concern. Balance was better for the outsiders than letting either Macedonia or the Athenians shatter the other. The other states watched and waited, looking for opportunities to gain and warily sniffing for threats. There was the potential for the conflict to broaden and grow in ways hard to predict. Yet not everyone in Athens welcomed the renewal of open warfare with Philip. Aeschines and his allies argued that the war was unnecessary and dangerous. The king was not a threat, or at least not an imminent one, or the most important problem facing Athens. For the moment, such opinions were in the minority, and the majority of voters approved the war. An even smaller minority saw Philip as a great leader, who might prove the savior of all the Greek states. Since the end of the Peloponnesian War, plenty of people had deplored the unending succession wars and revolutions that as Greek fought Greek, and a few believed that they had discovered the cure. The key was poverty. Too many citizens lacked sufficient land or other sources of income to be comfortable and secure. The less well-off envied the wealthy, and the wealthy competed with each other, fueling power struggles within a city and attacks on other polis. This handful of thinkers claimed that all this could change if the Greeks joined together in a pan-Hellenic cause and attacked Persia to take the land and the wealth. Once conquered, the Asian barbarians would work the fields and tend the cattle as slaves or helot-like serfs, leaving their Greek overlords to live in comfort and harmony. At least capable of elevation of all that was the finest about Hellenic civilization. Victory was taken for granted, for the philosophers voicing these ideas shared the common belief that the Persians and other Asians were naturally inferior. They would be cowards who would easily be defeated as long as the Greeks were united. The Easterners were also former enemies, so there was no need for any other reason for turning on them. Ideally, the inevitable triumph would be the product of the Greeks willingly joining together through mutual goodwill and realization that such a war would benefit every city. When their impassioned speeches and pamphlets failed to bring the states together, advocates instead urged the dominant city of the time to set an example and persuaded others to join. Sparta, Thebes, and Athens were all addressed in this way. But many philosophers, and not simply those preaching a great war against Persia, began to lose faith in city-states, and especially democracies, and instead placed their hopes on charismatic tyrants, such as the tyrants in Sicily, Jason of Pharae, and his son Alexander, who were all urged to lead the great war. And as his power grew, so was Philip. One of the most persistent voices raised in this cause was Isocrates of Athens. Head of the rhetorical school, the great rival of Plato's Academy. By this time, aged about 90, in 346 BCE or possibly 344 BCE, he wrote an open letter to Philip, tailoring the well-tried arguments for a pan-Hellenic crusade against Persia to this new hero. It was a great cause, bound to bring honorable glory so that his reputation would rise as one of the foremost men of history, while if you fall short of your expectations, you will at any rate win the goodwill of all the Hellenes. This was far better than trying to dominate Greek cities by force, since even success in such endeavors was bound to make him hated. Philip was urged to persuade the Greek city-states, and especially the most prestigious of all of them, Athens, Sparta, and Thebes, as well as Argos, to serve together under his leadership in the greater cause. With the peace of Philocrates freshly agreed, Isocrates claimed that Athens would readily join the king, and lamented that his city had not already led the way. He challenged the many critics of the Macedonian king, dismissing the claims of Demosthenes and like-minded politicians for falsely painting Philip as a tyrant out of sheer jealousy and the desire to stir up conflict. Such men were selfish and irresponsible to present him as an enemy to the Greeks rather than an obvious leader of the willing. So this is where we get into some real interesting ideology, because we're so used to just thinking of Philip bad from the Greek standpoint, which of course based for the most part on what took place without any explanation, to seeing this system, this set of philosophers, this set of leaders who are trying to do a variety of things. Here we have the one that says we should make Philip join everybody together against Persia. Well, one of the great goals of the Greeks was to get even with Persia for the Persian Wars. But of course, there are other people on the other side, so we'll be looking at the other groups next before we continue on with Philip. But he is not really, at this particular time, interested in taking over the rest of Greece. You're going to have to kind of force him into doing it. So we'll see how that comes about in these little stages that I'm breaking this up into. Now, the sources for this, The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch, Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond, In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.